The scripture reading this morning comes from Matthew 15, 21 through 28. And if you would like to read along in your pew Bibles, it is in the New Testament, page 17. Jesus left that place and went away to the district of Tyre and Sidon. Just then, a Canaan woman from that region came out and started shouting, "Have mercy on me, Lord, son of David. My daughter is tormented by a demon." But he did not answer her at all. And his disciples came and urged him, saying, "Send her away, for she keeps shouting after us." He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she came and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, help me." He answered, "It is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." She said, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Then Jesus answered her, "Woman, great is your faith. Let it be done as you wish." And her daughter was healed instantly.
It's been a hectic last few weeks in my life. I sold my house before it went on the market, so all of a sudden I had to move out. That was a bit of a challenge. Chandler and the boys came briefly and put a few things in boxes and said, "Okay, everything else you can do with whatever you want." So I've been sorting everything. What goes to Michigan? What's for the yard sale? What's to the thrift store? What goes to Urban Ore for recycling? What goes to the dump? I had a yard sale 2 weeks ago that cleared out a certain amount of the stuff, but there was a whole lot left that I kept sorting. As I sorted, I would put things out where the yard sale was on that Saturday, and people kept wandering by and taking things home with them, sort of a free cycle, curbside experience. I saw someone one morning saying, "I love the things that keep coming out here. You have such great books." And I said, "You should see the ones I'm keeping." So I started boxing all the things finally that needed to be shipped to Michigan and lined up a moving company to come and pick those up. And then just about everything that was left by that time took to the dump in a couple of dump runs, thanks to Bud Sisson and Leonard Nielsen and their two pickup trucks. And the movers came 10 days ago, loaded up everything, and headed for Grand Rapids with stops along the way in Sacramento and Denver. And I still have this little electric pickup truck that I bought a few years ago when gas was $4 a gallon. And I wanted it to be shipped to Michigan. But it's a little hard to ship because it has three wheels. It has a center wheel in front, so it doesn't go onto a regular car transport vehicle. So I spent a lot of time on the phone and email trying to find someone who could take that particular vehicle to Michigan. And I found someone, and they emailed me, said the estimated date of pickup would be the 26th, yesterday, right? Yes, yesterday. And that they would call to give me the exact time to pick it up. And so then yesterday morning, the phone rang, and there was someone with a very heavy Eastern European accent and a really bad cell phone connection, and I could hardly understand a word, literally a word, that was being said. But I was able to get some sense of the word truck and today and 6 p.m. So I said, "Okay, you're coming today at 6 o'clock. He said, "Yes." "Okay, good." I had some things I needed to do back at the house. I'm living with Kathy and Donna and the girls now. So I went back to the house and did some cleaning up and taking care of some last few things. About six, I stopped and made sure the truck was ready to be picked up and went back and worked a little bit more, and it got to be 7, and that wasn't too big of a surprise because they were movers, and, you know, and it's always kind of general. And then I thought, well, I could call them and find out for sure what's going on, but it was so hard. I was a little reticent to do that because the bad cell phone connection and the heavy accent, I thought it was just going to confuse things. So I had my books with me. I just sat and worked on my sermon for an hour or so. And then it got to be 8. And I started to be a little concerned. So I thought, well, I'll call. I wasn't quite sure what the number was. I scrolled through on my cell phone, finally found one that looked like it had come in that morning and looked like the right thing. This is the one called, and there was the guy, same heavy accent, and I said, "This is Karen Stokes in Berkeley. Are you coming tonight?" And I heard some sort of muttering and some confusion and some shuffling around, and I thought, oh man, he forgot. He messed up. I'm hung out to dry. And he came back on and he said, "We were already there this afternoon, and it's all unloaded, and your husband signed the papers on it." And I thought, I'm talking to the wrong mover. I'm waiting for a truck that delivered stuff to Michigan 4 hours ago. It is never going to come to Berkeley. I was waiting for a truck that was never going to arrive. Now, there's this interesting new book that Catherine Schultz wrote called Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. And it talks about how in our lives, for a lot of good reasons, psychological and logistical and practical reasons, we tend to assume we're right, right up until that moment when we realize we're wrong. And our perception shifts, that sudden 180-degree oops experience. Up until that moment, we're confident and assured, maybe a little angry at these movers who messed up and aren't showing up when they're supposed to. And then all of a sudden, you realize your error, it shifts over to embarrassment and perhaps anger, sometimes shame or remorse, depending on how serious the error is that you just realized you committed. And she talks in her book about how hard it is to face the fact that we were wrong about something. How few cultural resources we are given in this culture for dealing with it. How hard it is to say, how little practice we get saying, "I was wrong." She said we have two alternate versions to saying, "I was wrong." The first one is, "I was wrong, but..." When we give the excuses and the justification for why we were wrong and basically say, "I wasn't really wrong after all." Or we use the passive voice, "Mistakes were made." Politicians are really good at that one and have been for years. It's not, "I made a mistake." It's this idea that the mistakes somehow kind of made themselves and I happened to be in the room at the time. Again, both of those, "I was wrong, but," or "mistakes were made," tend to absolve oneself of responsibility for the error and for its consequences. We act, when we move through life, we act in accordance with what we believe to be true. What we believe to be true about the world, what we believe to be true about other people, about ourselves, about God, about family, about science, about religion, all those kinds of things. We tend to act in accordance with what we believe to be true. And because of that, we assume that we are right as we move through life. When that belief is challenged to the point at which we are proven to be in error, that is a hard moment. And the difficulty of it varies depending on how painful it is to recognize the seriousness of the offense or of the error, of the mistake. When our belief is challenged and we're proven to be in error, something has to change. That's the hard part. We have to accept that we were wrong, or we have to scramble to find some defense of what we believe to be true so that we can still hang on to that old belief. We have to find someone to blame, someone else. She has this whole wonderful section on the ignorance defense, the idiocy defense, and the evil defense, that the other people were either ignorant, they were idiots, or they were evil. That's why that bad thing happened. So that's the way we tend to deal with error in this culture, and I can cop to all of those. Jesus gives us a different example in this story of his encounter with the Canaanite woman, and he does an admirable job of dealing with his error in this story. The background of the story is that Jesus comes out of this tradition that the Messiah has come to save the Jewish people. It is part of Jewish culture, this expectation of this coming Messiah. It's coming to save the children of Israel. and had no, there was no understanding of a mission beyond the Judean community, that the mission was not to the rest of the world, and there was no particular responsibility for the people of the rest of the world, of the Gentile world, the non-Jewish world. And so as Jesus is traveling up through Tyre and Sidon, this is Gentile territory. He's on his way through, and there are crowds there, and he wants to escape from the crowds, so he sort of takes refuge in a home there, and this woman finds him anyway, the Canaanite woman. She is a Gentile woman. She is a non-Jew. And she comes to him and says, "My daughter has a demon. She's sick. Save her." And the disciples are angry because she keeps shouting and calling out for help, and they're saying, telling Jesus, just send her away. And she comes to him and says, "My daughter is sick." And he says, "I'm not here for her. It's not fair to take the children's bread, to take what I'm bringing to the children of Israel, and throw it to the dogs, to the Gentiles. My mission is elsewhere." And then she kneels down and challenges him and says, "Yeah, but even the little house dog under the table gets the crumbs that fall." Jesus was stating what he considered to be true. My mission is to the children of Israel. And she challenged his belief system and said, "What about this? What about the little dogs that still need to be cared for?" She believes in him, even though he doesn't believe in her. And in so doing, she challenges what he is thinking and the assumptions that he is acting under, and he sees this when she kneels before him and realizes his error, and he fixes it instantly, it says in Matthew. "Woman, your faith has cured you, has healed you." He affirms a new view of reality. He affirms her view of reality, and he changes his own. He doesn't say, "I was wrong," which really would be nice to have in Scripture someplace so that you could quote. And remember there in Matthew 15 where Jesus says, "I was wrong," you know, "go thou and do likewise," kind of thing. But he does make amends, which 12-step people can affirm. He realizes he did her harm and he makes amends. Now, therapists who work with couples and with families say you can either be right or you can be in a relationship. Very rare that you get to do both at the same time. And that's what Jesus knows in this story. He could say, "I'm sorry about your daughter, hang in there. I have this other mission that I'm doing." Or he could say, "Wait a minute, even though that's right, according to my whole belief system, there's this relationship that's calling out to me. There's this woman kneeling in front of me begging for her daughter's life." And so he sets his rightness aside for the sake of the relationship. Peggy Alter gave me a poem years ago, and the first line says, "In the place where we are right, no flowers grow." So as I'm going through this transition into the next chapter of my life and sort of looking back over where I've been so far and the things I do well and the things I do not so well, most of the mistakes that I have made and continue to make happen when it's more important to be right than to be in relationship. Raising kids because I said so. It's a good answer sometimes, but a lot of times it's actually not very helpful. I'm the mom. You get tired of the struggles and the negotiation and the adapting and the compromising and the trying to be attentive to their emotional state and stuff, and you finally get to the point where your thinking gets rigid. I'm speaking for myself, where my thinking gets rigid and my heart gets less generous, and I go for being right rather than being in relationship. Even though I am right. It's amazing how much they've come around to that. It's that Mark Twain line about, "When I was 16, I thought my dad was the biggest fool in the world, and now that I'm 25, I'm amazed at how much he's learned." And spouses too, the same thing. Are you going to be right or are you going to be in relationship? There's this wonderful quote of an overheard dialogue at the beginning of Catherine Schulz's book, overheard in Grand Central Station, November 2008, something like that. One person, I said crumb cake. You said pound cake. I said crumb cake. Why would I have gotten the pound cake? I don't like pound cake. Well, I saw the crumb cake, but I didn't get it because you said pound cake. I didn't say pound cake. I said crumb cake. Maybe you meant to say crumb cake and said pound cake. I said crumb cake. It's like the quote, you know, there's a quote from Ben Franklin and then there's that at the beginning of the book. And those family relationships too. Is it better to be right? Or is it better to be in relationship? I've had to learn this in a new way with my mom as she's getting a little bit forgetful. And she'll ask me the same question that she'd asked me the day before. And at first, I would say, you asked me that yesterday, remember? Which was true and right, did nothing for the relationship. No help whatsoever. And finally, I realized there was no skin off my nose just to answer the question again rather than to try to convince her that she had forgotten something. She does not need to be told that she forgot something. She wants the answer to the question. For me to keep working the other thing, that's like waiting for that truck that's never going to show up. And the same thing here at MPC as I look back on these 12 years here. Most of the mistakes that I made, not all of them, most of the mistakes that I made have been around wanting to be right rather than dealing with the details of relationships. When someone offers constructive criticism, if I'm not in the right mood, my first response is to defend the actions that are being criticized and give the reasons why I was actually right in doing or saying or thinking whatever it was that I did or said or did or thought. And rather than take the time to be open to what might be useful and helpful in what is being said. What is this person trying to communicate to me? What do I need to learn from this? How can this conversation enhance the relationship that we have or build a new one? And if I have to be right, that truck never arrives. In Terra Linda, the church that I used to serve, there was a situation like that where a woman who hadn't been real active in the church called me and said she needed some spiritual support. Could I come over? And I said, sure. And I headed over there, opened my heart, ready for compassion, and said, what do you want to talk about? And she launched into this long list of criticisms of the church. Programs, people, direction, everything she thought was wrong with the church. And it took me by surprise. That was not what I thought I was going to be hearing. And it set up all of my defensive stuff, got going right away, and I wasn't prepared to operate in the mode that was probably necessary at that moment, and I disagreed with many of her statements, and I let her know. And I left angry and frustrated. She was probably angry and frustrated, and I stewed about it for the rest of the day. The next day I called her up and said, can I come over? Sat down and said, I'm not happy with how I related to you yesterday, and I want to give it another try. I'm not happy with my response to you. You called and asked for spiritual support. What do you need from me? And it took some time, and it took some negotiation, and I had to keep sort of refocusing myself and a little careful guidance of the conversation. And finally, she said that her adult son was struggling with alcoholism and she didn't know where to turn. She was feeling really guilty and ashamed and scared for him. So once I got past needing to be right about the church, I got to be in a relationship with her. And it ended up being a pretty good one. And that points to something else that I've learned here at MPC. We had a consultant who came in to help with the reconciliation process after we went through some conflict a few years ago, and she interviewed a few people, and she read surveys that people had filled out for the reconciliation team, talking about their experience, and she said, there are two categories of issues that I see when people talk about what they are upset about or were upset about. She said that there's this one category that has to do with the organizational structure and processes within the church, and there's the other category that has to do with emotional issues and emotional hurt. And she said it's very important to be clear on which issue is being presented, because you can't fix an emotional problem with a structural solution, and you can't fix a structural problem with an emotional solution. Both are valid, both need to be addressed, but you can't fix one by using the strategy for the other. The lady in Terralinda had an emotional issue. Her son was dealing with addiction, she was dealing with guilt. And her first solution and mine was to go to the structural problem. Let's talk about what's wrong with the church. Things she's unhappy about with the church. And that was the wrong thing to do. Again, that was waiting for a truck. If we stayed there, that was waiting for the truck that was never going to show up. We could have wrangled about that one for the rest of our lives. It didn't address the real issue. And it wasn't until I realized my error and went back and said, okay, let's talk about the real thing here, that things began to heal. That takes a lot of time and energy and attentiveness to be in relationship. My mentor once said, you can't be both authentic and expedient. And when I get tired, when I get stressed, it's hard for me to go there. It's hard for me to go to the tending to the details of a relationship. I'll miss things that people are trying to say to me. I can be short with people. Under extreme circumstances, I can give up on people. Unlike Jesus. But in Catherine Schulte's book on being wrong, she says that realizing our mistakes disrupts, at best, she sees mistakes as an opportunity. She said it's much more important to be wrong than to be right, because the opportunity is in being wrong. It disrupts our status quo. It disrupts our usual ways of thinking and gives us the opportunity for reflection, for reinvention, she says, and even for pleasure, that discovering our wrongness can be revelatory rather than something to be ashamed of or angry about. There is loss. There's loss of any picture we may have had of ourselves as omniscient and infallible and beautifully compassionate beings. Darn. I hate that. But the rewards are great. When we're willing to do the work. Just ask Jesus. Just ask the Canaanite woman. Just ask her daughter. When we're ready to be in relationship rather than being right. Just ask all the outsiders that Jesus was able to be in relationship with, because he accepted the Canaanite woman's challenge to change. As I was working on this sermon, there was one song that kept coming into my mind. I thought I'd do a little bit of it this morning. It's Tracy Chapman's song about Would You Change? Really, really hard one to listen to, but an absolutely fantastic song. So I'm going to end with that this morning. If you knew that you would die today, saw the face of God and love, would you change? Would you change? If you knew that love can break your heart when you're down so low you cannot fall, would you change? Would you change? How bad, how good does it need to get? How many losses, how much regret? What chain reaction would cause an effect? Makes you turn around, makes you try to explain. Makes you forgive and forget. Makes you change. If you knew that and would you change? Would you change? If you knew that you would find a truth that brings up pain that can't be soothed, would you change? Would you change? If you saw the face of God and love, if you saw the face of God and love, would you change?